Hello, I'm Wilma Allen, and I'm doing interviews for the Amelia Island Museum of History Heritage Keepers Project. And today, which is August 24th, 2017, I'm interviewing Dr. Kay Johnson, who is a longtime resident of Fernandina Beach, and I'm happy to speak with her this morning. Dr. Johnson, would you like to say something?
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. How are you? I'm delighted to be here because I think there's such a strong heritage. I can't imagine not doing something to preserve it. So if I can offer anything, I'm glad to do that.
Good. Well, I have a number of questions that I'd like to ask, but basically you tell me what you think is important to be in the archives of the museum,
things
that you remember about and
thoughts. Where would you like for me to start?
Well, why don't you start with yourself? When were you born, and
I was
your,
born
something about your parents?
I was born here in Fernandina in August 1932, and I was born on a house on South 7th Street. My mother was a teacher. She taught English in what was in junior high, and she taught here for 40 years. My father, and she put on a lot of plays, too, for the junior play, the senior play, and so on, women's club. And my father variously was in shrimping for a while with Harry Somm, and then he had a gas station on 8th Street, and eventually ended up working with Ranier in stores. And he was probably one of the top five baseball fans that ever came through Fernandina. He and Jaime Fischler and Pete Ingram, Stapleton all went several years in a row to the World Series. And he and Albo Alvarez used to go to games in Tampa and, you know, all over the state. So he was a big baseball fan. When the World Series was on at home, we had to pull the shades, turn out the lights. He'd have two TVs in one room and a radio, and we weren't supposed to walk through that room I mean, he would frown if we did.
Well, he was involved with getting some of those farm teams to come and practice wasn't he? Something like
I
that?
Don't know how involved he was in getting them here because I was not living here full-time at the time. But he was very interested and had an association with them and found places for them to live other than the Keystone. They wanted something other than a hotel.
So and that was in the 60s, 50s?
I think it must have been 60s.
60s.
Probably late 50s and early 60s. And he would find, he particularly found this one place that belonged to friends of ours from Miami who had a house. And it was a furnished house, beach house they used. And he would always rent it for them to these folks. And after they were leaving, the manager would call him and say, "Would come out to the house and let's see what we need to do." And they'd look, and the manager would say, "See what you need." And he'd look, and he'd say, "Well, we need a new bedspread," because they'd put all the clothes in the middle, bundle it up, and put it in the truck instead of packing. "Or we need a new chest of drawers," because they'd taken the drawer out. And so he really loved that association. It was nice.
But that was when you were already grown up. So when you were a child, growing up on South 7th Street, did you?
No, I grew up on North 3rd Street.
Oh, okay.
So. And, gosh, the neighborhood that I lived in North 3rd and North 4th, there must have been 15 children. And I mean children within a range of maybe, if you want to say 10 years, there were the Corbetts and the Clarks and the Allens and the Brunies and the Kellys and the Wards and, goodness, the Combs and Matthews used to come because their grandmothers lived on that street, so we were never at a loss for people. You know, there were places such with the Allens. There were two boys on the corner, and they had a BB gun, and I was not supposed to walk by their house in the afternoon because Charles might put my eye out for the BB gun.
We had the twins in our neighborhood. The twins are out there.
Well, we had twins up on the hill, too, Lois and Doris, and one day they came down in their red wagon, and They were always crazy about the twins. They were identical. And they put me in the wagon and took me to town. I was out front playing, and no one knew where I was.
Kidnapped
you. Just some excitement.
So you went to the public school?
I went to the public school here, where, as I tell you, my mother was a teacher. And I went first through 12th grade in the building, which is now a school board building on Atlantic. And I can remember my father talking. My father had gone to the old schoolhouse, mm-hmm. The one they're turning into a hotel. And so had my aunt and some of my cousins. And he was telling me, he said that, you know, how wonderful that was, going in this brick building. It had a bell and so on and on the top. And then my cousins, his nieces, went there. I guess one of them was in the second grade, and her father happened to be, I think, chairman of the school board when they built the new building. And the day that the new building opened, the teacher just had them all take their books and walk up on the hill, and so they didn't have to pack the books. I thought that was inspired. Very good.
Yeah, good idea. But
that was by the time, or maybe just a few years after I graduated, they had to put in portables, and because of enrollment, and, you know, we started thinking about building another.
Was the Peck School operating
at
that time?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Because I remember
Peck School's been, I don't know the date, but I can't remember when it wasn't there.
One woman I spoke to, Mabel Pratt, I think she's the one who said that when they opened up this Peck School, all the kids in her class got in the line and marched from the school you went to. All were so proud to go to their own school.
Yeah.
And had the picture in my mind of all these little kids so proudly going to their
school. It's wonderful that the community's using that mm-hmm. now as it should, and I look forward to events there and so on.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, did your grandparents live here
mm-hmm.
in Bernardino also?
My father's parents, my mother's parents were from Georgia. My mother's My father's mother was born on Cumberland and lived there. And my father's father was Norwegian. And he ran away when he was about 13 from Norway and shipped out as a cabin boy on a steamer. Ended up, I think they said Shanghai. No, that was not true. Burma, I think. And he was Shanghai, I guess that's where I got that for his cabin boy salary. And so he shipped out on another steamer and came to Fernandina, and then to in and out of Fernandina in New York, and eventually ended up here as a harbor pilot. My grandmother, who lived on Cumberland, had a brother a little bit older, and Downs was his name, Robert Downs, and he was a harbor pilot. So they both ended up, living in Old Town, back-to-back houses.
Hmm. Interesting. And you knew them? They were still alive?
No, I never knew either of them. They died before I was born.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting person.
I know. I would like to have known them.
So, they were harbor pilots, and then your dad and your mom had other
mm-hmm.
businesses that they were involved in. So when you finished high school, do you want to tell me a little bit about school?
Oh, my goodness, it was love going to school. Mm-hmm. You got to see everybody. You had really good friends. I was talking with a colleague I had at JU that come several weeks ago, and I said I was going, it was my birthday, and I said I'm meeting two friends over here for lunch. And I said, actually, two friends I've had since I was 5 years old. She said, I don't even know anyone I knew when I was 5 years old. And I was thinking about that. You know, I have probably a number of friends that I've known, some since I was 3 years old.
That's wonderful. So, yeah, that's wonderful.
It really is. I can't, as I said, I can't imagine any place any better.
Yeah, that's great. So then you you told me this before, but I have to ask you again. Yeah. When you finished high school, you went off to college, but it was kind of, you had a couple of opportunities.
Well, I'll tell you this too, because I think, again, it's reflective of the opportunities of a small town. When I was in the 11th grade, I really wanted to be a page or a messenger in the state senate. My cousins had been, my aunt Margaret Stewart had been married to a state senator, and so their daughters had been pages, and I'd heard about all this, and I really wanted to be, and I never knew him, and so we knew the state senator MacArthur, and so he arranged it, and I went up. I would come home every weekend and get work, and I was up there and lived in Tallahassee for 6 weeks when I was in the 11th grade, and I'd come home every weekend with the representative.
Wow.
And that was just another opportunity that you have when you're here. And I graduated, and I have an aunt, I had an aunt in California who was in education, and I guess I never realized that she exposed me to a lot, and that may have been some of the reason, in addition to my mother being a teacher, that I ended up in education, because it was not something I intended to do. And my mother and I, my father, had visited California a number of times, and so I kind of set my sights on Stanford University, and that's where I ended up going. And it was a long way from home. That would be the only regret, if any, because I still see friends, but I would see more, of course, if I was closer. But it's amazing. I mean, for example, last year, one that I'd known all through college came here and spent 6 weeks. She remembered I'd talked about it, and she saw what a nice resort, so she came. And, you know.
Sometimes they enjoyed it, I'm sure.
I see several of them every year.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So then you came back to Florida.
Well, I went on and got my master's at Stanford as well.
Uh-huh.
And I had a nice offer in Palo Alto, but I'd been away from home a long time, for a lot of time, and I thought I'd like to get closer, but I didn't want to teach in Fernandina because my mother was teaching here. And so I thought, Miami. And so I called, didn't know anybody in Miami, I called from Palo Alto and got a job in Miami. They hired me over the telephone. And
good credentials. Connections, too,
probably.
Oh,
I don't think there were any connections. And my father drove down with me after the summer. And we found a place for me to stay, and we went out and looked at the school, and it wasn't there. It was a new school, and they were bringing in portables. And I started crying, and he said, I'm taking you home. And I said, absolutely, no, I'm not going. So I took him to the airport, and we had a nice dinner, and he flew home, and I went back to the place we'd found, and from there on I met people, and, you know, really, it was wonderful. And I ended up teaching, I taught in several schools down there, elementary school. I ended up teaching at the lab school at the University of Miami, and I really loved that. At the time, I was president of the Florida Association for Childhood Education, and we had a board meeting with people from all over Florida. One of them was from Jacksonville University. He was the director of student teaching, Paul McClendon. And he said, why don't you come back to North Florida where you belong? And I said, oh, I love what I'm doing down here. And he said, well, come back. You'll get a free trip home. So I flew home, and that was nice. And I fell in love with JU. It was so pretty. Even took a pay cut, but just fell in love. And so decided I'd come back. And I think it was good that I did, because my father died about a year and a half later. And it was good that I was close.
Oh, sure. So. But you didn't live in, you lived around Jacksonville?
I lived in Jacksonville. I had an apartment, but came home every weekend, just about, sometimes in between.
And so that would have been in the
60s? In the 60s.
So that was still during the Cold War and all kinds of stuff going on.
There wasn't a lot of it at that time at JU, because by then, after some of it, by the time I was there and spending so much time, a lot of it had filtered out.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually we got to streaking, which was interesting. We had a lot of that at JU.
Streaking,
you remember
that?
That
was when people would run to
town
naked.
I was streaking.
Streaking,
and I was chairman of the discipline committee at JU. This lovely young man who was on the basketball team, really tall, and he was sort of a light coffee colored latte, just really handsome. And he was brought up for streaking. He said he not only was he brought up for streaking, he did it in front of the president at a baseball game. And the only thing he had on was his shoes. And he streaked over there. So he was written up and he came up before me. He said, "Well, Doc, I had a bag over." He said, "If the man had a bag over his head, how did they know who it was?" And I thought, "There's nobody on campus your height and your color." I mean, what do you mean? How did we know? And every time I'd see him on campus after that, he'd say, "Hello, Doc. Being good. Keep going. Being good."
Well, that's good. That was a main.
That was a biggie. We had a lot of real funny incidents at JU.
So, but you. You used to come here regularly to see your folks,
my mother was here,
your friends and everything. So
my mother and I have a lot of relatives in town that are so good to me.
A lot of, I'm sure there were plenty of changes. How did you feel about the
changes? The biggest change was probably Center Street and as you know, took up the bricks and so on. But I think they did a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. I was very pleased. I think my mother was not real thrilled with the way, with the curves going in Center Street when she would drive down. But I thought it looked good, and I was so pleased they left the original bricks for the crosswalks. And mm-hmm. I thought Suzanne Davis and George Davis, Suzanne Davis Hardy, and George Davis, and so many of the others, Bino, and so I think they did a good job. Mm-hmm.
So that was all brick before.
It was all brick. It was just the same brick as the crosswalks. Those are the exact bricks that they used for the crosswalks.
Did you find, like some people have said, that there were more stores where you could actually buy things that you needed
mm-hmm.
at one time? Mm-hmm. Now it's mostly tourist
stores. Yeah, there were grocery stores when I was growing up. There was an A&P and a Piggly Wiggly and some others on Center Street. There was a Piggly Wiggly, and A&P were catacornered from each other across from the palace and that way.
Hmm.
And the bank was on the corner, again catacornered the other way from the palace, the Florida National Bank. Mr. Mazzell, who lived in the Hoyt House, was president of the bank. And I can remember going in with my little bank book and he'd wait on me.
So it was a real sense of community then.
Yes. And I was thinking about that the other day. I was telling you how many children lived right around North 3rd and North 4th Street. And you never wanted for company. It was always around. But we also, I walked and rode my bike. I mean, it was nothing to ride my bike to the beach when I was 10 or 11 and to the fort. We'd ride down the fort. It used to be a shell road, and we'd go down the fort. And it was really, you know, a long way, but you never thought much about walking. And we had a post office box from the time I was rather young. And so one of the things I would often do would be to walk down and get the mail.
Mm-hmm. You said the other day that you can drive up even now and get your mail.
Yes, in the back. But I used to walk up the side steps on North 4th Street on skates. Some of us would. You'd hold on the banister and go up and then hope you could make the last step.
On the skates that you clamped on your shoes?
There's a chip out of one of the steps that I insist happened when I fell, but one of the quarter girls said it happened when she fell.
Somebody did it. So you don't? Do you have memories of what was going on with World War II and People must have been called in to go to war.
Well, I remember that we used to, you had to have black electric tape across the half top of your headlights when you would, if you were in town with them on. And if you would go to what we used to call the approach, which was the main beach, we used to call, here's Atlantic and here's Fletcher. And from Fletcher to the ocean, we used to call the approach. Well, you're approaching the ocean, I guess. Yeah. And when I was really young and during the war, we'd drive out at night and just sit with your lights off and look at the horizon, and sometimes you could see ships on the horizon, but you'd have to turn your lights off when you went up on the approach. And I can remember one night my parents were in the front seat and my Aunt Margaret Stewart and I were in the back, and we were watching a ship on the horizon, and all of a sudden it exploded.
Oh my
And the next day at school, in fact the next week, people were talking about the debris that had washed up, and I know one of the things that washed up was a case of malted milk tablets, which I guess was one of the stores on board that they had, and you know, they were there for the taking, and I probably had one. I mean, they had them at school. And I remember the Moore family that had, they had a restaurant and a grocery store out on the approach. And they found, I believe it was a chest that had washed up, and it had a letter in it. And I'm not sure if my memory is correct about this, but I think it was from Denmark, so the ship might have been a Danish ship. And anyway, they wrote to the family to let them know that. And I think sent the letter.
Did you ever find out why it blew up?
Well, it was torpedoed. It was
torpedoed.
By Germans. I mean, that was probably the correct conclusion. And there were reports all the time of German sailors coming in at the fort and around that way. You know, it's a natural harbor, and it would have been a great place if anybody was going to try to get in. It drew enough deep water to get close.
So yeah, I had heard that people would go out and watch for enemies.
Yes.
Did it frighten everybody?
I don't remember that. I know that, and I don't know whether they were, I guess they were Coast Guard, would ride horses up and down the beach as a patrol. And people, Suzanne Davis, Mary Agnes Wolfe, Mary Holt Johnson, were plane spotters. And they would go out to a tower, which I think was in Old Town, and they would look for planes. They had cards that had the outline of the plane.
To tell what they were. Wow. Yeah, I would think living on the coast at that time must have been pretty scary for
them. And it was rationing. You had little stamps and a book. And I can't remember much that was rationed. Sugar.
Were a lot of the men gone because they were in the service?
Yeah, a good many, but I was sort of in the middle. They were all older that would have been away, or if they were fathers, they would be younger.
What about when, it must have been in the 70s, when the nuclear subs came into...
Well, I was away from here most of the time, but, you know, there was a lot of controversy about it. It's exciting, and I think that, due credit, wherever that should be placed, and it should be given, that I think it's been handled well. And I remember going out with Kevin and Lucille one time several years ago. And I had somebody here in town, and we were taking just the historical tour up and down. And somebody on board said, "Oh, look, there's a turtle." And I looked and I said, "That's not a turtle, it's a seal." And I was just taken back. I mean, you don't see a seal. And Kevin said, "It's a seal," said, "they're the ones trained over at King's Bay to sniff out subs." And it had I think it was a red collar around its neck.
Yeah, they wore a little vests or something.
And so very soon, a boat came by us and it had a man in a chair in the front and a gun sitting there. And he said, "Now turn your boat toward Fernandina and go to channel so-and-so and stay there till we tell you we come back for you." And so we did. And what they were doing was escorting us up out beyond, you know, to the ocean. And then they came back. We continued. Hmm. Kevin knows a lot about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably in the tape that Bill Thompson made the other day. And then so you were at JU working through most of the integration changes.
Well, it was the end of the 60s and 70s. Fire truck.
Oh.
I don't remember any huge significant thing happening at JU in regard to this.
Or here in the island.
Well, I thought they, you know, I wasn't on the scene, and my mother was not teaching at the time, but I don't know, you know, if this is a good observation, but it seemed to me that the school system here did a good job in that in the elementary schools, they took the three elementary schools, and they had different grades, like kindergarten to third, kindergarten to second, and then I guess third and fourth and fifth and sixth. And so everybody those ages went to that school. There wasn't any if, ands, or who goes where. You knew where you went. And I thought that handled it well. I was director of student teaching, and I remember going out to look at a student, see a student teacher observe. And it must have been shortly after segregation. The student teacher was black, and we were at a school where most of the children were white, but there were some black children, and they were in line, and I'm standing there. This little boy who was black came up to me, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm just visiting with Miss So-and-so." And he said, "Are you her mother?" And I thought, well, you know, maybe integration's working.
Well, you certainly had spent a lot of time with children, and you set up with a whole preschool at JU?
Yes, with 2, 3, and 4. That started somewhat accidentally. Florida, must have been 72 or 73, and Florida, the legislature had mandated that anyone teaching kindergarten had to have 2 courses in early childhood education. And I had just finished my doctorate at FSU and in early childhood education. And of course, I ended up teaching the first 2 courses that were offered in Jacksonville for it, so teachers had to come to be certified. And in my first class, I had a lot of them were 5th and 6th grade teachers taking this to get certified to teach kindergarten. I think some of them may have thought, well, it's going to be a shorter day or something.
Yeah.
And anyway, there were men, and that was gratifying. And I thought I was doing such a good job with them one day. One fellow raised his hand and said, "We have no idea what you're talking about." He said, "We haven't seen a little child since we were one. You know, since I was one, I haven't seen one." And I said, "Well, do you know any?" And so they got together and they brought in 9, 3, and 4-year-olds. And they set up a classroom. They pulled in things. They taught every day. And that's what we did for the class. And it went really well. And when it was over, the parents wanted us to continue with it. And one of the students' parents, of course, then had to pay. And one of the students was willing to do it as a teacher. So that's kind of how it evolved. We were in different places, classrooms, and schools.
Cool.
Now we have a lovely building. Nice. We have about 90 children enrolled overall.
Yeah, you must have been very pleased over the years as so much more emphasis has been given to early childhood education. That's my impression.
Maybe so much more positive and introspective attention, looking at it as something other than just looking at play, I think is really good, and recognizing how important play is. And I think those things maybe are a little bit new.
No, let's see. Interesting. Let's see. Now, you had some brothers and sisters.
No, only John. I have tons of cousins. I probably have 21 cousins this year.
And most of them stay around here?
Well, about 21 in Fernandina.
Wow. So,
maybe a few that I don't see very often either here, but they're awfully good to me. I grew up just less than a block away. My cousins lived, they were all older than I. There were three girls and a boy, and the Stewarts, and they lived up on the hill.
Hill is where?
Which is at the end of North 3rd Street. So they were about less than a block from us. My aunt was a widow. My Aunt Margaret Stewart was a widow. And she and her husband had lived in the house that my grandparents lived in and that my father grew up in after they moved from Old Town. And so her children were born in that house. Three girls, all of whom ended up living here. The boy, who was the youngest, was a dentist here for a while before he moved to St. Pete.
Yeah, you told me that's the house that's now painted a kind of a violet color.
Yeah, it's sort of a, I think, I believe it's, they had a fire a couple of years ago, and they repainted it, and I think it's sort of a light lavender right now, last time I looked. Mm-hmm. They've done a nice job cleaning it up.
Yeah, and apparently that area beyond there where the port is now was a very lovely field.
No, it was a gorgeous, it wasn't a field exactly because it was boggy. It was, damp and right next to the river, but it was a gorgeous view.
And the man I spoke to earlier, Mr. Holmes, he said that there was a baseball field that teams used to play. I think the black teams would play down.
At the end of third?
Not at the end of third, maybe at
end of second.
He said it was where the port is now.
Oh, okay, Second Street.
So it's probably Second Street, closer to the river.
Yeah. Second Street.
But he said that was a great place for the kids, mm-hmm. and they enjoyed playing mm-hmm. ball, and he misses that area mm-hmm. too. So I guess it was a nice mm-hmm. section of town.
Well, it was, in Fernandina, there were, I guess there were sections where there were just black people. I know there were just black people, just white people. But there were a lot of sections where, they'd be back to back, and that was one of them. Like all of Second Street, when I was growing up, they were all black people. All of Third Street, they had white people. I suppose there were other streets. I know there were.
That would be on the north side of Center Street, or just all
on
for
the
north, a whole section of town.
I think it might. Well, on the north, but there were streets like that all over. I mean, if you go down 6 and Broome, all one side was white and all the other side was black. Hmm. Not on Broome, but behind Broome. I think that was the way Fernandina was built. I mean, you built where you needed to build.
Yeah, and where you felt you could get land and where you felt comfortable, I guess. Okay, so when did you move back here?
I went to JU, I think it was 68, and kept an apartment over there, but my mother lived here, and I was always back here, back and forth. And then I retired in 2004. Mm-hmm. But I moved back here full-time the year the Dames Point opened. Because when the Dames Point Bridge first opened, I could get to JU in 45 minutes.
Yeah, right.
Now it's about an hour and 10 minutes.
So even when you were a young person, we didn't even have the Shade Bridge to go across to Newley.
Oh, yeah, we didn't call it the Shade Bridge, but
it was the same.
We called it the Drawbridge.
So there was a Drawbridge.
Drawbridge.
Yeah.
We called it the Drawbridge, and then when it was, and the Drawbridge is still there. It's to the if you if you're going over it to Jacksonville, it's on your right.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking of the one to Yulee. Isn't that the shape?
That's the one they call the shape bridge.
Yeah, what was kind of bridge was there?
A drawbridge.
Oh, okay. So, okay, that's what you're talking about. I was thinking of, all of a sudden I switched to
the
crazy bridge.
You think of the one at the south end of that?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't there for a long time. And then I don't remember when.
So the drawbridge is still there by the shade mm-hmm. bridge?
It's used for trains. The train part of it is still used.
Oh, okay. So it was like one bridge and trains had one part and cars had the other part. Oh, that's interesting.
And then... I don't know when it was, but it must have been in November when I was, I think I might have been in elementary school. A boat ran into the drawbridge, and so you couldn't use it for several weeks. And it was near Christmas, and some people were caught on the other side of the bridge with their cars because they'd been in Jacksonville. So they had a ferry. It was actually a boat of some sort of barge. And you could take it across. And Mac Junkin Bus and Truckland had one of their buses on the other side when the bridge when the boat ran into the bridge. And so you could still go to Jacksonville, and you could still go on the bus. And some people had cars, and they would make exchanges. And, but I can remember going on that ferry and freezing to death, so it had to be like November or December.
Mm-hmm. So you got off there, and there must, to get on the bus, there must not have been a regular dock to get off and for pedestrians.
I don't remember that, but we managed. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody managed to get on. You go to, because we always went Christmas shopping in Jacksonville.
What about in medical things? Like you had the hospital here, but it was, I guess, a small general hospital.
Oh, well, you had Dr. Humphreys at first, who delivered me, and we lived on Fifth Street when I was very young, before we moved to Third, and Dr. Humphreys lived on Sixth, so his back door was right across, and he loved dogs, so he also took care of all our dogs. We'd take our dogs to the back of his house, but we'd go to his office.
Yeah.
And then after Dr. Humphreys, there was Dr. Lingenhauser here. And so then after Dr. Lingenhauser, it was Dr. Dickens and Dr. Bruton.
So they must have taken care of just about
everybody. They did. My aunt in California had a stroke, and so eventually I brought her here. And they had a place across from the fort. I think it ended up, they tore it down this year, and I think it ended up being run by the state government or something, but then it was a private facility, and it was called, I think it was called San Jose, and it was brand new, and we got a room at the end with a bath and brought her furniture and so on, and so she stayed there. And she was sick one time, and she couldn't walk very well. She was sick one time, and so I called Dr. Dickens, and he said, well, bring her up to the house. So they put her in the car. I drove up to his house, which is on Center Street, right next door to the Methodist Church. It's the Methodist Church office mm-hmm. now, and Dr. Dickens lived there. And so I drove up, and he came out with his bag and knelt down in Center Street and opened the door, and she was in the passenger side, and he took care of her in the passenger side.
Oh, my goodness.
He did that several times. When I tell people, they say, oh, yeah, he'll do that, especially if you can't walk. And he would do that down at Center Street if you couldn't walk. Apparently, people said he did. I never saw him. But he'd do it right below his office when people couldn't walk up the steps. He and Bruton both would come down and take care of people in the car. Their office was over.
That wasn't Dr. Jeffries, was it?
Mm-mm.
No, because Dr. Jeffries is a
no, it was Bailey Dickens, Ben Dickens, mm-hmm. and Cecil Bruton. Ben and Bailey were brothers, and Cecil was their brother-in-law.
Ah, and they were MDs, and they...
And they had offices upstairs over, what's there now? It used to be a drugstore. I don't even know what's there.
Because on the tour, the walking tour, there's a building called the Jeffries Building, mm-hmm. and that...
That's older.
Apparently, there was a dentist that used that space on the corner on the second floor.
That was Rutherford.
Maybe this guy.
Which is it on? Is it on the north side or the south side?
It's on the north side, and it's on the corner, and it has a white circular.
That was Rutherford. Oh. Bill Rutherford.
Okay.
And
apparently, according to the story that gets told to the tourists, he was a dentist, and he used the light that could come in from those various windows to focus on. Get a better view of the patients. And then he also would take care of people on the street.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure he did. That? He was, because the Dickens and Breedens were on the same floor. All of them were right there together.
Oh, okay. So,
so they were all, and you had to walk upstairs. So. And I remember Bailey Dickens' waiting room, which had linoleum on the floor and chrome furniture with the leatherette seats. Yeah. And Barbara, his wife, often would be the receptionist. She'd been a Burgess here in town, Barbara Burgess Dickens. And they lived, as I said, in the house next to the Methodist church. And I remember being fascinated. He had a cannonball in his bookcase up there. So he had a TV that had this. I never saw a program. It was always gray and white squiggly lines on it going up and down. Yeah, it's typical Norman Rockwell.
Yeah.
Waiting room.
Did you have things like Halloween and homecoming parties?
Oh, Lord, yeah. The best Halloween parties growing up were at the Lighthouse. And loved the ones O'Hagan's had, because when you would drive up, and my folks or a relative would take me up, you'd drive with all this foliage on the side, and they would have all these scary things in the foliage. And sometimes Helen's brother, Tommy, would jump out at you. And so it was always nice, scary to go up there. The Stuarts would often have Halloween parties and let me invite, younger people to them, too, up on the hill. I'm sorry that nothing was ever done about anybody who lived on the hill, and they're all gone now, and I tried my best to get them to do it, and I don't know if any of them ever wrote about it, but it would have been Noonie, Rue Parton, and Sister Anderson Sweat.
Now, when you talk, you said the top of North 3rd Street. How big of an area would that hill have been? Because some people say 18th Street has a big hill. Is that still part of what you're talking about?
No. I mean, yeah, it might be the whole ridge. I don't know. Uh-huh. It might be a whole ridge. I don't know. But 18th, I think 18th may be the highest place on the island. But I know that Harbor Pilots moved to 3rd Street because it was a high place with a view of the water. Mm-hmm. So they could see, ships coming in. As I told you before the other day, there at one time there had to be, maybe 5 Harbor Pilots living up there.
Yeah.
Same thing.
And the people like the Noonies and the other people, they were...
Noonie was their first name. Florence.
Oh,
did you know Eldridge Parton?
No.
It was his wife, Florence Rue Parton, but she was called Noonie.
And those were friends of yours when you were growing up?
Well, I knew them. Yeah. They were a little bit older, but I knew them. They lived up on the hill. They were all the Andersons, Doris and Lois, the twins I told you about, their brothers, and my sister, 2 sisters.
So what other things were important to you kids and young people growing up here? The beach must have been the key.
Oh, we went to the beach all the time, and the casino was there. We used to, the casino had a skating rink and also a bowling alley, and usually small pins, but we would go bowling or skating, and there was a restaurant downstairs, and then underneath that it was up on big pilings. So that you could always go into there for shade, if you were out at the beach during the daytime.
And could all the kids use it?
Mm-hmm. It was public. You paid, of course, for the skating rink or bowling.
The black kids could use it too.
I don't think so. I don't remember seeing that. No. I don't remember that.
But,
you'd have to ask them. I don't recall okay. that.
Let's see now what other questions did I have.
And there was a grocery store on Main Beach. See, that was at Main Beach. You go to Main Beach, and if you're facing the ocean, the casino was over here. And then there was all this space where the parking lot and the grass is now. Mm-hmm. And then on this side, there was a restaurant and a grocery store that the Moors owned. And the restaurant kind of doubled at night as sort of a club, nightclub, I guess.
Kind of where Sandy Bottoms was.
Yeah.
The other beaches weren't developed at that point, I guess. But there were a lot of homes that I understand that there was a hurricane that wiped out almost a whole street.
Was not developed. What was wiped out, and I think it must have been in the late 40s, was North Beach, one whole road there. And the road that you see now when you go down, you see the dunes, and there's a road, and there used to be another row of houses.
Did you have worse storms then than you have now, do you think, or about the same? Have you noticed any difference?
No, I haven't noticed much. Hurricanes used to be really exciting for us. We didn't really fear them that much. And not very many people lived at the beach full time growing up. They might have beach houses or they would rent houses, but they didn't live full time. And almost many of the houses, and I think most of the houses, were summer homes for people who didn't live here, or a few for people who lived in town.
From people from other areas like Atlanta?
Georgia mainly. Not so far north as Atlanta, mm-hmm. but South Georgia. Mm-hmm. Waycross, Blackshear, those places. The hurricanes, when we used to have them, they didn't have, you know, the advanced things where people fly into them. We didn't have that much. Prior knowledge, nor did people know a whole lot about the eye of a hurricane. We knew that there would be a storm and then there would be a calm and then there would be a storm. But we used to ride out the beach during the calm and see what had happened. We'd ride all around and see what was going on, and then we'd say, well, we better get back with the rest of it. And we'd always, my folks and I, would always go up on the hill to the Stewart's house, my cousin's and aunt, and because it was a bigger house. And we'd churn ice cream and make fudge and do all those things. So it was, you know, you got to stay there with them. So it was entertaining.
Mm, sure.
And there weren't that many structures to do damage to. I mean, certainly they lost a lot of the summer homes, but some of them were very small, and some of them, with the storms in mind, had not been built to withstand because they knew they couldn't do that. So.
Hmm. Smart way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You live at the beach now.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the house I live in was one that we used to rent. My parents would rent in the summertime sometime. It had two bedrooms and a bath, and it had a cypress plant paneling inside. And we would rent it in the summer, and it was on pilings, and it was north of where I live. I don't know exactly where, but it washed off the pilings in a hurricane, and my father bought it and moved it down to where I live and put it on a cement block foundation. And so I keep trying to shore it up. I mean, it's certainly very, very, it's got to be 60, 70 years old. And all the other houses are new, but I keep trying to shore it up. I'm in a desperate state right now because my wonderful handyman has just moved. And I'm looking for one.
Well, it must have been a strong house if it survived a hurricane, even though it got knocked off of its piling.
Well, and I don't know. And then when I moved over here full time, I had a little bit of it redone. And unfortunately, I kind of had to sacrifice the cypress paneling to get done what I wanted because I really liked it, but it was awfully dark, mm-hmm. and it needed lightning. but well, I like where I live.
Well, that's great. Most people like living at the beach. Let's see. I don't think I have too much more specifically to ask you, but I do wonder if you would tell us a little bit about what you think maybe people, newcomers or the next generation, should keep in mind about Fernandina Beach as we move forward. Or Amelia Island, if you have any thoughts on the museum and local
history. Well, I think the museum is wonderful, and I think the direction it's going and the things they're doing. I'm excited about the coming Gerbing exhibit they're going to do, and I think they're awfully good about putting things together. And Fernandina and Phyllis and Gray are just doing an admirable job with it. No, I think the museum is doing a great job. I'm concerned about the growth and the way it goes, and I joke about it a lot, you know, that people have not gone home since Labor Day, but I think that we've got maybe to be less ambitious about some things and a little more careful about others, or are we going to lose the flavor?
Which things do you think we should be more careful?
Building permits, building codes, looking at protecting more land that's not developed, keeping the flavor, I'd like to say what Fernandina was, but at least what it is, and not go beyond that. It's a little bit distressing, and I joke about the traffic and parking and you know that, but I'm surely and sincerely joking about it. But I do have a great deal of anxiety about the growth and the way it's going, and I'd like to think that there's more control. But I'm also a believer that if you're not going to do something about it, you probably shouldn't complain, so I'll shut up.
Do you think the downtown, like the Center Street, with when it used to be more a part of the people who lived here's lives, now it's so tourist-focused? But
well, I have a hard time dismissing the idea that it doesn't belong to me. I still think it belongs to me. And so sometimes when I think I may have told you that I had to come down 3 days before I found a parking place to buy Camino Island. And I said to the nice lady in the bookstore, I tried to buy this. I spent 3 days doing it. And she said, it's really nice for our business, isn't it? She said, but do we like it? I said, don't ask. I know that we're dependent on the business part. I understand all that, but I don't know what else can be done. But I wish something could be done.
Well, it is a lovely community, and I guess the different people that I've spoken to, they all seem to feel like it's been wonderful. Whatever kind of life they led, you know, they matured and grew up and feel this has been pretty ideal.
And I need to say something about the schools, too. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful education. I really did. And when I went from here to Stanford, it never occurred to me that I could have been lost. The only problem I had when I got there was in biology, because they gave me something and said, find a paramecium. Well, I'd never had a microscope. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, the schools were wonderful. We had great teachers. The curriculum was good. I think the schools were going in a good direction. I think we got good leadership.
Do you get involved at all with the schools here?
Yeah. I've not been. I have been somewhat involved with the child care at our church, which is the Methodist Church plan. And I know, of course, the people in the schools, and I just feel that we've got a lot of quality there that is in the right direction.
I hope we continue to get good teachers like you must have been.
Oh, I don't know that, but they had me sub up here 1 year for, I think, a month before I went back to college. They were some, I don't know what had happened. The teacher was supposed to show up. So I did teach here for a month. Taught third grade.
And your mother didn't get in your way?
She was in a different building.
Oh,
she was teaching
junior
time. No.
So is there anything else you'd like to go on the record with?
I can't think of anything except please, please, please preserve the community and all the good things about it.
Keep these memories alive.
Yes.
So
I'm glad you're doing that.
Well, thank you. It's so interesting to talk to all these people.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And I guess we'll say so long.
Okay.
And thank you so much, Dr. K. Johnson. Bye.
Bye-bye.